Hey, before we start this episode, just want to remind you that the Fearless Woman's Guide to Starting a Business is available everywhere that you like to buy books, and you can get it in paperback, Kindle, and even as an audiobook. I'll have links on where you can purchase in the podcast notes. Okay, back onto the show.
You are listening to One Broken Mom, a podcast dedicated to raising awareness about mental health, parenting, and self-improvement. I'm the host, Ami Quirconi. One Broken Mom is not a family show. It is intended for adults only and may contain adult language. Sometimes the topics are serious, but you can count on the episodes to be entertaining. Also, One Broken Mom is not offering any psychiatric or medical diagnosis. We're just here giving away useful and important information. So, if you're ready to hear real talk by real people so that we can all get better together, then you're in the right place, and welcome. Well, today I'm pretty excited about this episode. I have Kareen back on One Broken Mom, and we both have been kind of chomping at the bit, I think is a word. I'm going to totally steal it from her right now at this point, to talk about this topic today. And for those of you that are watching on video and actually listening, she is recording this. Where are you at right now?
I'm in like a sports hall in my little town in Switzerland where my kids are having a tennis lesson.
Right. Yeah. So there you go, folks. This is real live podcasting. This is what we love.
That's
about
right.
Yeah. And so we're back today because we're actually talking about one of the topics that I wanted to attack when I started One Broken Mom, which was not just to dive into the stories and the therapies and understanding of childhood trauma, but there has been for decades a lot of really weird parenting advice that has been super popular that has shifted. And when you understand what some of the things that like our parents and their parents were told about what was good about parenting, you might start to get an idea of why the choices that they may have made weren't just blind, you know, that they didn't just come out of nowhere and that they weren't just bad instincts, that there was actually some really, really, really messed up stuff that was going on in history.
And let's call it what it is, right? Like, I think a lot of the parenting styles based on the earlier part of last century were traumatizing for kids.
Yeah, they were. They really were. And so this is a topic. I mean, one of the things that I love about Kareen is that, you know, when I met her, you know, in the course of this year, I've met some amazing people, and the ones that I'm just like, I got to have them back on. And she's definitely one of them. And what I liked about her was that you're a studier too, like me. And it's not just, you don't just stay in your lane of like, I'm a therapist. Like, you know, if I did that, I wouldn't be doing a podcast show. But the fact of like, there's so much to learn and understand out there. And so you have also done a lot of digging into this topic, and you just, you know, and I think that it's important. I think that when people put this in perspective, this is going to be one of those episodes of going, wow, okay, so that doesn't make any sense. Or again, to add to the body of knowledge that we're all gaining here about ourselves and about life today and how we got on this journey as a culture to where we are and why the shift really does need to happen. So tell me a little bit about your interest, and how did you kind of get into digging into the history of parenting on your end?
You know, I think we talked about this last time, but I did study anthropology. That was my graduate degree. And I didn't come into the study of anthropology, maybe, and I was actually quite surprised when I got there that a lot of people didn't seem to share my interest in understanding the human condition. And for some people, it really was just a degree. And I was like, but don't you understand who we are and how we got to knowing ourselves as we know ourselves today? That was a huge motivating question for me throughout my young life, I think, based on the experiences I'd had. And so I came to anthropology really with this curiosity and, for how we really, how do we stand in our bodies today, and what are the influences? I like to call it like the soil in which we grew, like understanding what were the components, what were the nutrients or the anti-nutrients that were in the soil from which we were formed and shaped. And I feel that that is actually a hugely important and often a missing component to understanding us as human beings, because we don't realize that we were born into a culture, and we often don't realize that we were not born into a vacuum. You know, who we are or how we know ourselves is not an inherent given. It's something that's formed over time. It's the evolution of ideas. It's the introduction of cultural influences that shape then the further evolution of those ideas, and then how they come to impact how we experience ourselves in our bodies. That, to me, is so it's actually so liberating, you know? It tells us, like, well, wait a minute. You know, how I see the world right now isn't necessarily how the world is. And that means that there are alternatives. And that is really freedom. I think, really, when it comes to trauma, knowing that there's a way out of the way you experience life is totally liberating. So that's really what drew me to the entire question in the first place was, ideas as they evolve over time and how culture plays a role.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually the last week's episode that I did, Dr. Saliha Baha, she also is a research therapist. And she said the same thing that, you know, you can't look at science today that we have. And I know that I am definitely prone to do that. Like I have that scientific piece of me of where like it's data and it's numbers, right? So it's not necessarily I buy into interpretation of the science from everybody because, again, as we talk about, even like I don't want to go on a tangent here, but when we talk about environmental issues, science out there is being evaluated. And that when we see two different sides to the same data, that's the cultural influences. That's the other mindset and the filters that we have that we bring to this.
Exactly.
Right. And so she said the same thing. Yeah. Like you have to look at, you can't even look at research today and an absolute because we are getting out of research what someone's bias going into the research is looking for.
Totally. I work for, actually part of one of the hats I wear at the moment is supporting a very prominent pediatric researcher here in Switzerland. And I'm very much a part of the research team. I love research. I love scientific research. I love being in an academic research environment. But I also like to conduct these little kind of mini low-key ethnographies, you know, when I'm in that environment, because I am so curious about exactly that, this kind of the black box of science, the idea that empirical data is devoid of any kind of bias, exactly like what you said. And when you're really looking for it, you can see all of the ways that even the approach one takes to addressing a question or the question one asks or doesn't ask is going to be shaped by their experiences. And I see it all the time, every day in that environment. Yeah. And it doesn't mean that the research isn't beneficial. It just means that it's very much the product of its culture and its time.
Right, right. I was sitting here thinking to myself, like, I think the two of you in a room would just bore the shit out of a whole lot of people with you and I just talking back and forth with each other. I could just see it's like, yeah.
Totally. Oh, that's hilarious. Totally 100% agree with what you just said.
Right. Okay, so let's jump in right here. You know, when I started to kind of dig back into, I feel like it's important to go back at least to our grandparents' generations, I think. I mean, we keep going all the way through, but it's the best and the best documented, you know, set of information that we have in terms of childhood manuals that go back to like the early 1800s. And, and I think understanding then, and because I've had this conversation with other people and they're like, yeah, but not, you know, this was before the internet. So not many people knew about it. And I'm like, well, a bestseller is still a bestseller. So maybe the volumes weren't big, but when a book hit the market and it was a bestseller about parenting and it told you that you should give your kids only cold baths and don't kiss them when they start crying, that's kind of an important piece of our parenting history. So what's the earliest piece of really effed up parenting advice that you found in your study?
Well, I also agree with you. I didn't want to go too far back because we could probably go all the way back to, I don't know, the Middle Ages. I mean, you know, I mean, there is this important consideration that, you know, the conditions of the world that the people lived in did in some sense shape how close they felt they could come to. Do you remember like hundreds of years ago when plagues were the norm and children, infant mortality was as high as it was? I remember reading this in high school that, you know, parents didn't really bond with their children. And part of it was this idea that, well, they were likely going to die. There was a good chance of it at least. And so the bond between a parent and a child really wasn't there. But we could go all the way back, but I also agree. I think the early 1900s, so early 20th century, is kind of where I started to become really, really interested, because that's around the time that child psychology as a vocation or as a an established area of research was getting underway. And you have researchers like John Watson, who popularized behaviorism, and he published The Psychological Care of the Infant and Child, and this was considered to be the science of child rearing. And John Watson was actually the one who popularized a lot of these, one of which you just referenced, this idea of kissing your child too much. Mm-hmm. He actually popularized that idea. There was this quote that I actually heard recently that I wanted to read to you, because it was so interesting, but he feared that excessive affection towards a child, especially by the mother. Well, back then the fathers were largely absent, right? Mm-hmm. But excessive over-attachment would lead to this excessive neediness in a child. So he warned against too much love and affection being given to the child. And he said that over-kissing a child could lead to problems down the road. And he defined over-kissing as kissing a child more than once a year.
Oh my gosh. And this was in the book, people.
Yeah, and not only that, I think it's also important to understand that just because he was an expert, but he went on to write for some very, very popular publications. He became known as a pop psychologist. He was maybe one of the first pop psychologists. So he published things like Harper's and McCall's and Cosmopolitan. And he published a lot of parenting articles. So this is really where a lot of women, mothers, started to consume this kind of material. And it was popularized. And that's important to know because, you know, obviously if you're taking a scientific paper from a journal, obscure journal, your average parent is not going to access that. But it's exactly what you said. When it becomes popularized, it's written in a best-selling book or it's written in very popular magazines. This is how it gets into everyday person's hands. And I think what's really interesting to me, and this is more of a question than an explanation, is that there seems to be a correlation between, for example, the cry it out method and the introduction of these kind of this very sort of detached mode of parenting. Mm-hmm. With the end of the Second World War and the increasing interest that many women had in working, you know, post-World War II. You know, we know during World War II that women, a lot of women did enter the workforce to help out. And then after the war was over, this tension started to be introduced. More women started to feel this feeling of being caged and wanting to also engage in other ways. And so some of these parenting techniques, like cry it out, for example, a lot of women saw this as an opportunity for them to attain more freedom,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right? Like to free themselves from the bonds of parenthood or the bonds of motherhood, which at the time really lay at their feet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, I believe Watson, if I recall, he was also, because his outlook and his methodology was so startlingly sterile. And, you know, and when you sit there as a person who's been investigating trauma, right, and you're able to look backwards in time through the lens of more information, I believe he was the one that had a terrible relationship with his mother, like an awful relationship with his mother. Like
I remember hearing something like that.
Yeah. And so you look at it and you go, okay, in the lens of how he wrote that, his own filter was based on the fact that he actually did. This is, you know, he legitimately had a painful, you know, sterile relationship with his own mom. And that influenced his beliefs around this topic, you know? And I think that there was another one. Emmett Holt was another parenting advocate from around that same time as well that had similar views. And again, it doesn't take much to be able to dig into the history of these men, by the way, that, and I'm not saying any men can't be good dads, but these were men who had conflicted relationships with their mother that were then telling other mothers how they needed to parent their own children. And we can see today that that's like, oh geez, that's like, that's not good ideas, you know? Now you brought up around during the World War II. And that was the emergence of Dr. Spock. And he came onto the scene as an antithesis to the Watsons and the Holtz of the world, who had, again, best-selling information, because he was really an advocate. And I know a lot of people think that they know Dr. Spock because they read his later work that came out like in the 60s. But the first book that he came out with in 1946 really harked back to there's common sense in parenting, and your gut mom is what you need to be listening to. And it went back to, because women, I believe, even mothers were like, I don't know that this feels right. I know you're telling me that my kid needs to eat only every 2 hours and that I have to stop breastfeeding at 6 months. And, you know, and he's crying and clearly in distress. And there's something in me instinctually that's saying this is wrong. But yet my books and my articles and Cosmo told me I need to do something different. And Spock was the one that went back and said, you guys already know what you need to be doing. You need to start to honor your instincts. I mean, what have you, I mean, you know, let's talk about it for a bit.
Yeah, I'm so curious. Like, I'm curious about your own experience sort of being parented. I mean, because I guess our parents would have been raised in the Spock generation.
Right.
But actually, when I look back at my own mother and her home environment as a child, I think that her mother was very much still influenced by this idea of the detached parent. Mm-hmm. You know, she was a mother who couldn't, who she in her entire life, in her children's lives, she could never say, I love you. Mm-hmm. She could never say the words, I love you. And it came to a point where my uncle actually traveled to see her one weekend and spent the whole weekend trying to get her to say those words. And she could never get them out. Mm-hmm. And for her, love was less an expression. It was less about affection and touch and words. Not that that's love is only in those things, but for her, it was very much like love was an obligation. You did things for people that you were obligated to do, and that was your way of showing them, of course, that you cared.
Yeah.
So I, you know, it's funny. I read up less about Dr. Spock because I was more focused, much more focused on Watson. I think because I was thinking about the environment that my grandmother was very influenced by, mm-hmm. and that in turn influenced my mother and how she experienced it. But she did, I remember that she did reference Dr. Spock. Mm-hmm. I remember, and I don't know his work as intimately, mm-hmm. but I do remember her, I think she very much wanted to be able to trust her gut when it came to parenting, and she parented it in a very different way than my grandmother did. So she was very affectionate. And she was very open with how she felt. She would express things freely, but she was also heavily traumatized. Right. And this leads me into more of the sort of attachment theory mm-hmm. idea. Maybe you could describe my grandmother's this kind of avoidant personality, and I think almost to counter that avoidance, my mom developed this kind of very almost erratic, but very oppositional kind of parenting style where she
was anxious, and also the
overly involved and the best friend mom kind of parenting style. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And totally. I don't know how that fits in with Dr. Spock's theories. Maybe you can tell me a little bit more. I love this idea of the, you know, from the gut parenting.
Right.
But my question would always be then, I think there are a lot of people who have not been connected enough with themselves to know what it means to be followed by their gut instincts. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. I mean, because if your gut was, you know, based
guided
on your gut,
it.
Right? Yeah. You know, back to your, you know, your first question after the question, which was about the parenting style that I experienced. Well, I will tell you that I don't recall my mother being my mother wasn't a reader. So, you know, going into parenting books and diving in was not a part of her norm. But when we talk about the sterility of parent, you know, and that's about the best word I can think of. I mean, we know what sterile means. It means that there's no, you know, there's nothing to it. It's just, it's almost, you know, it's vanilla. It's just plain there. And my grandparents, which is why I go back to, you know, where were they at? They were hands off. I remember a story that my grandmother, because this was the other piece of parenting, which was back when she had my uncles in the 40s and 50s. My mother was the last one born. She's the youngest of three and 52. Mm. And she had my grandmother had my oldest uncle during World War II in the 40s, and then my next uncle in 49, I believe. And back then, what they did was they knocked women out and they gassed them. And they pulled the baby out.
That's right.
And you weren't even awake during childbirth. And then the baby got whisked away and you stayed in the hospital for 7 days. Like the whole attachment disconnect didn't even Absolutely. Happen in there. And that was the norm for women to, and That's how right. how childbirth actually happened there. That's a huge influence too on whether or not you have that opportunity to really kind of bond and understand
bond
it. But it was kind of like, yeah, this yeah. is just a mechanical thing. We're just going to point this thing out and put it over here. And, you know, because it's fine, you're fine, you know, yeah. don't worry about it. But my grandfather's side of the family, my grandfather was always the strong, silent type. I mean, unless, and then when he didn't speak, it was loud and it was sometimes, you know, he was the guy I remember growing up, the guy on the sidelines when at sporting events that was yelling at everybody, you know, kind of, but definitely the strong, silent type. And his, he has a brother, or had a brother, I'm sorry, that moved away. He's kind of very much the same lifestyle as me, kind of packed up and left the family and just moved off. And he ended up committing suicide in his 60s. And I think that when I reflect back, unfortunately, I don't have the benefit of any data of sitting down with my knowledge that I have now and to have conversations with my family. But given the yeah. fact of how he wasn't very expressive and very communicative, I can only imagine that that was a lifestyle in the family that he grew up in. Now, my grandparents were also, when we talk about the history, one of the other people that I've read is Paula Foss, and she's mm-hmm. a historian that has studied childhood.
Yeah,
and the looking at the socioeconomic and the ethnic backgrounds of the U.S. culture is an important piece of this. And when I examine, you know, the life that my grandparents had, they grew up in the Depression. And that Absolutely. In itself is a traumatic experience for children and parents. And that's when this division of, you know, pre-World War II, where in order to survive the Depression, boys were pulled out and put to work, especially in rural communities. It was a different influence in the Depression when you lived in the city, because maybe you lost all your money in a different way. But the Depression in the Midwest actually lined up with the Dust Bowl as well, which was a tragic, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. event. And the Dust Bowl was really a big deal when you grew up in, you know, my family grew up, they were from Nebraska. And so, mm-hmm. you know, that having that influence of that trauma in there, that was the lens in which they were also parenting from. So it wasn't just because some guy out there had said something about how to parent. Really what
influenced That's right.
on a day-to-day basis was life, the life right outside
Absolutely. The
doorstep that had a huge piece of it. So now you carry that forward to my grandparents that grew up in the Depression, and then in their formative parental years, it's World War II. They are parenting yeah. through World War II, which is a traumatic experience for a couple of 20-year-olds to sort out their life and their world and what it means. And I know at that point in time, that's about when my grandmother's anxiety developed. And my grandmother never got on an airplane after the 40s, like never got on an airplane after that. She was, and my grandfather, ironically, was a pilot.
Wow.
Yeah. And so, you know, her anxiety developed at that point in time. And then she had miscarriages. And in the 1950s, they started handing out DES, which was a drug to prevent miscarriages, because they thought that miscarriages were a preventable disease that we could treat. And so women in that time period were being fed this drug to prevent miscarriages. And as we know now, from biologically speaking, as sad and as devastating as they are, not every pregnancy ends up being a viable pregnancy. And
that's right. You
know, miscarriage is unfortunately one of those factors there. But back then they thought they could prevent it. What that did is that developed my mom into a DES daughter who by the age of 25 was experiencing cancer and had to have a full hysterectomy, and chose to have her second child because they told her she'd never be able to have kids again. So get one out now. And at that point in time, my mom wasn't ready to have two children. She wasn't ready to have one child. And so she pumped out another kid just to be able to do it because she had cancer and was going to have to deal with it. So,
Oh, me, obviously. Yeah.
right. So did Dr. Spock have anything to do with that? No, I don't think Watson did either. But that is, as we're talking about culturally, when we take a look back, what were other influences there that had something to do with it? Now, you know, like I said, going back to Spock, his thing was, what's your gut? What's your gut telling you, Mom? Well, let's talk about guts. And if guts are formed based on your experiences and you have those experiences, those are tough ones, right?
That's right. We know from, for example, Stephen Porges' work, this idea of neuroception, that we can assess the information coming to us in sometimes faulty ways. You know, for example, a mother might think that she's responding to her gut when she's worrying excessively. Mm-hmm. And that's not what we necessarily want to promote. So I think there is definitely, and something I'm very interested in teaching is, there is an informed intuition that we can help people come to, but it starts first by, you know, healing this very real trauma that's both cultural, right? It's cultural in the sense that we've inherited it from the experiences that our grandmothers and our parents have had. We have remnants of those experiences affecting us and influencing us and shaping us in many ways. And I think when we start to heal that process, I think then the gut can, I think, be a more reliable source of guidance for us. But I completely agree. And my grandmother also grew up in the Great Depression. It was funny, before she died, in the years before she died, I became really interested in capturing her stories. So she lived to be almost 101, which is already quite remarkable. She grew up on a farm in Missouri. So also very Midwest, ended up in Wisconsin, a small town, Wisconsin, in Wisconsin. My mom grew up there as well, and her siblings. And I conducted a series of interviews with her. So I brought a recorder, and I have this one fantastic interview where I'm asking her all about that time. You know, I mean, in this, mind you, it's many, many years from the actual lived experience of that time, and she's recalling it, but she had a very good memory. But it was fascinating. And I actually encourage anybody with a tape recorder and some curiosity to do exactly that, to go and record the stories of your parents, your grandparents, your aunts and uncles, because it's fascinating what you can actually learn and glean from how they experience life. My grandmother, you know, she really, I think, she had a very kind of typical puritanical, a very puritanical view of the world and a sense of what it meant to live your life and what you were obligated to do. So she even felt obligated to have children. Mm-hmm. She didn't want, when I got pregnant with my little boy, my first child, when I told her I was pregnant, she goes, "Well, why would you do that?" And I was like, "Grandma, I'm married." Like, it's actually probably the best time I could imagine in my life to actually have a child. And it is funny because I think the older she got, the more she lamented the fact that she ended up having children. Mm-hmm. She didn't live the life that she wanted to live. She got married. She felt out of obligation. She had children out of obligation. She loved her children in the way that she could love them. But it looked more like this kind of service, you know, I feed you, I clothe you. Isn't that enough? Mm-hmm. Which brings me to the interesting story of Harry Harlow. Who, you know, he was the psychologist working out of the University of Wisconsin Madison who did all of those experiments with Reese's monkeys. Mm-hmm. And he was looking to overthrow exactly that idea that a child only needs or will attach to the person who feeds it. And he was able to show in his very controversial now studies on these monkeys, because they were really quite traumatized, some of these baby monkeys. Do you know this study?
I've had a little bit of it, but I'm not as detailed as you have in it, so go for it. Yeah.
It's really interesting because he basically set up a series of experiments in this sort of primate laboratory that he mm-hmm. constructed in Madison. And one of these experiments, he had a wire monkey, so very, you know, all metal, mm-hmm. but the wire monkey had the food.
Yeah, right.
And then there was a cloth monkey. And the cloth monkey was much more cuddly and soft, but it had no food. Mm-hmm. And what he found was, it ran totally contrary to what popular psychology was saying at the time, was that the monkey would always prefer to be closer to the cloth monkey, to be snuggled up. That's where it got its sense of security. It got its sense of safety. And it was more nourished by the cloth monkey. It would go over to the wire monkey to drink some milk or you know, eat some food. And then it would always go back. It would spend like 23 hours of its time a day with the cloth monkey and only go to the other one for food. He also did a number of experiments that were really quite, it's hard to imagine them being, I don't think they would be allowed these days, but by isolating infant monkeys for extended periods of time, and when they would come out, how severely traumatized
right.
they were by that isolation. But he set out to prove, his sort of, I guess, mission was to prove that that attachment to a child is, you know, is that affection and love are as important, if not more important, than food and clothing mm-hmm. is to a child. And he really wanted to show that. And he, of course, just like John Watson, had a troubled experience with his own mother.
Right. But went the other way with it, right? You know?
Right. Kind of. Apparently he wasn't the best father. So, I mean, I think the question was like, was he trying to figure out what he himself didn't understand? Do you know what I mean? Or what he himself seemed to lack and didn't have an understanding of. He was trying to understand this. What is it in this maternal, in the maternal attachment and the mother-child relationship? Because he was focused on mothers. Mothers are still considered to be, you know, the primary attachment figure, I think, for most children.
Mm-hmm.
So his story is also really interesting, and his work really did start to influence the tide, shift the tide, and shift the conversation from this behaviorist sort of a model of, you know, don't touch your child, don't kissing is, you know, over kissing is more than once a year, to actually affection and nurturing through touch is really important. But as we know, these kinds of changes don't happen overnight, and they're also not solely based on the opinion of experts. Maybe the opinion of experts is more like a zeitgeist, you know, that they speak to what's culturally prevalent. So it's interesting. It's interesting to see how the tide starts to shift and how it's, I think it's most definitely shifting now.
Well, and you know, in the history and the study of psychology, you know, I've said this before that, you know, we had these, we were able to do behavioral research on other species, right? Because it's really tough to bring in a bunch of babies into a study and deny them food and give them wire, you know, surrogate, you know, a vending machine for their food, right? So all we had in this realm of psychology all the way up until within the last like 20, maybe 30 years is that we had just this anecdotal research of like, I can watch it in something close. And so that meant that I think that when we looked at some of that, it was easy to dismiss the results of that because you're like, well, that's just monkeys. Humans are totally different. And then when you start to go into where we are today, where you're able to do, again, brain imaging research and you're able to, you know, not necessarily on infants as much, but when you're able to see and the stimulus of the neural pathways and how they respond and actually now see inside of human brains, that's where that shift is, you know, really happening in terms of, oh my gosh, like, wow, what were we doing? And now we start to understand that. And again, I do get that there may be some interpretation to even that research that'll leave some people going, well, we still don't know everything. And that's absolutely true. But we know an awful lot that there is some,
we know a lot.
Yeah, we do know a lot. Now, what's funny is, I found an article by Paula Foss and it was published 1 year ago today, actually. And she had written for an article on the Atlantic saying that we needed another Dr. Spock for this generation because now, our information is everywhere. It's at our fingertips. I mean, we can sit here and jump online real quick, grab our phone and we can get to know everything we need to know about how we should be parenting today.
That's right.
And there are carryovers from some of this, some of the old stuff. And also, you know, like we talk about gut, if our gut is traumatized, you know, our parents are telling us things that we should be doing. And we have to really, I think we have to be careful today. We have to actually not blindly take the advice of all of the people around us. Right.
Totally.
Because and I guess that's the point of, you know, today's episode is you really need to look at two things. One is what is the history of the person who's offering you this parenting advice? Is it because that's what their parents did and their parents before them did? And then what the context was that they learned that, you know, that parenting advice. And also, take a look at, what is the information that's out there that may be contradictory to it? Because the information that's out there that is contradicting things like spanking and, you know, corporal punishment and, you know, this very, you know, we all grew up, I think, for the most part in a very totalitarian. I mean, I remember the, you know, the physical punishment for not behaving instead of understanding why I was misbehaving or why my brothers were misbehaving.
Absolutely.
Like, right. And that's a huge shift for people. And so, today, I think it's more important for us to really be, to examine that. But yet at the same time, we're also working against the fact that social media, Facebook, you know, everything's out there and everything's at our fingertips. Is there anything that you're seeing that's emerging in terms of, well, I mean, I think we're in the moment right now of what's parenting advice today, you know, and what people should be doing today, but in the emerging thought. Yeah.
I have quite a strong opinion about that, actually.
Good.
Because I completely, I mean, this was my thing when I became a parent. This was like kind of my, what they call like an inciting incident for me. It was like the moment I realized that I didn't know what the F I was going to do, how I was going. I had a sense. I had a like a felt sense experience. I had a knowing that my children needed something beyond food and beyond clothing and all those things. I didn't know how to respond to them in the ways that I sensed that they needed. I didn't know how to be a foundation for them to rest upon. I didn't know how to be this strong parental figure. I didn't even know what that meant yet, really. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't at the time even articulate those ideas. It was just a feeling. Oh shit. Like, how am I going to do this? How am I going to be that parent who is respond able in the way that my children need to really thrive? And I had this crisis moment. One day I ran into my bedroom. I think my daughter was like a couple months old. My little boy is only about 14 months older. And they were out in the living room they were fine. They were rolling around. She was rolling around. He was playing with something. And I just went into the bedroom. I closed the door and I just broke down. And I remember it was around that one thing. Like, how am I going to do this? And intuitively, I knew it wasn't going to come from books. It doesn't mean that there isn't good information in books, because there is. But it felt more like anything that I was going to read didn't matter if I didn't do the work first on myself. Does that make sense?
Totally.
I knew I needed to find the path back to me, to some deeper level healing that was going to need to happen in order for me to actually, even when I, to know no good information when I heard it, mm-hmm. and then to implement that information and really to have a sense of discernment. I think a lot of parents, they're coming into parenting, and there's like all of their sense of confidence in what they're doing is externalized to experts. It's like, what expert sounds good? I had a friend at the time when my little boy was young, and she followed this one parenting expert who didn't have children, but that's neither here nor there herself. But she had apparently worked with many babies and had come up with this very, very, very strict, schedule for what a child should do, when they should sleep, when they should eat. And it was very, very structured. And I remember, because we were kind of together, we were both expats living in Zurich. And I remember every day she was calling me on the phone. She's like, so what did Julian do today? When did he sleep? How long? What did he eat? When? And I was always like, listen, I'm not doing that. I'm not doing that. I'm literally just wearing him all the time. Not because I think it's the right thing to do. Partly it was because I liked the closeness. I felt like intuitively, I felt like that was good for him and me. And also my hands were free. That's the bonus, by the way, of wearing your child in like a wrap, is you have your hands free. You can walk around the house. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and for me, it was, it was a process. It was a journey to learn how to trust myself even enough to know what was the right information and how I could implement it. And I think, you know, I grew up with the wooden spoon. Just like you said, like I grew up with a mother who threatened the wooden spoon. And actually there's this whole, like, there are articles about wooden spoon parenting that kind of shocked me when I found it. I didn't realize, I thought it was just my mom, but it was apparently a thing.
Yeah. Because they were hanging on the walls in the 70s. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally. Like, don't make me get the wooden spoon. Don't make me get the wooden spoon. And I remember being terrified of that damn spoon. And you're absolutely right. It was so much about looking at the child's behavior and the extent to which the child was not conforming to some idea of how a child should be. And there was no consideration of the context or the environment within which the child was, you know, interacting, or that underneath their quote unquote bad behavior was this longing. Mm-hmm. For connection
and attention. Right. Right.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally.
Pam Leo was one that I had on the show, and she had talked about that. It's always when you're, you know, not always, we don't use always, there's no absolutes here, oftentimes, what parents are really struggling with. And when she said this to me, it was kind of like, yeah, you nailed it right there, is that you've got two humans with conflicting needs. And mm-hmm. and it's what you're usually upset about as the parent is that the need of your child is interfering with what you need right now or want to do, or your, you know, your wants at that point in time. And it, sometimes it comes down to wants, right? Your kid is not following along and playing quietly, and that it really in the moment you're trying to work and you can't because, you know, they're trying to get your attention, and then that escalates on their end to misbehavior because they can't get your attention. And so you're sitting there as a parent, and I there's a couple of Facebook groups that I, you know, I kind of jumped in to join and stuff, mostly just to kind of feel them out and everything. And I have to leave them because I can't even, because there's a lot of crowdsourcing with a lot of the same questions. I can't get my kid to do what I need him to do. I can't get my kid to do this. Like they're, you know, this management of the child. And then they're asking advice from a whole nother group of people that all have their own trauma stories and don't know they have trauma stories and don't have, you know, and they're all sitting there pitching. And I just, like I said, I have to walk out. Like, I mean, literally like digitally walk out of the room because I'm like, I can't even be in the space here. Like there's this feel. And I think to me, that's one of the scary things about the crowdsourcing of parental advice, you know, is to know the, you know the group that you're hanging out with, you know, and ask and sit there and go, is this really the group? And if you aren't asking that question, you're not listening to my show, for one, I can tell you that. But if you are, then you probably are trying to seek for some self-awareness, you know, in all of this, you know, my moment when you were talking about yours, was December of last year, you know, like a year ago, 2017. And it was having my daughter lean up against me while I was at dinner with her brother and a family friend after doing some Christmas shopping. And it was that, it was her leaning in for connection and me actually feeling really awkward. And because I didn't know it, but the difference was feeling like my initial feeling here is this awkwardness that she wants connection from me and I have no idea how to give it to her. And, but then realizing that that's not the feeling you want to be feeling as mom here, you know? So I was in that place of like you, like I know I want to be mom, but yet my gut, you know, that first gut, the first gut was the wrong gut, which was, this is weird. Get off me. And I fully admit that. And that was that moment there was my catalyst of, you know, one of many actually, but it was kind of like, it started to add some fuel to this of like, wow, you do know now that that's not a normal feeling for you. And that, that is how, you know, I started to connect the pieces. That's how I felt my relationship was with my own mother, was that there wasn't that connection. Yes. So I didn't know how to give, pass down. I was only passing down what I'd been given. That's and it was it. Like, I don't want to pass that down. Right?
No, you know? Exactly. I mean, that's how exactly what I thought. I mean, I only had a very particular, I had one model for what a mother daughter or mother child relationship could look like. I did get quite hungry for other, you know, other examples in the world. I was always the kid who liked to hang out with my friends' parents. Mm-hmm. Like I always liked to be around the mothers of my friends' parents.
Yeah.
Because I think, and I didn't realize it at the time, but I think I was looking for other models. And this is the thing about attachment, is that we know that children can form attachment to any adult caregiver. And it used to be pre-industrial revolution, right? Or in certain cultures, it still exists, this sort of, this allopathic parenting style. Mm-hmm. I don't know if we talked about that before, but this idea that a child can be nurtured and raised and form an attachment to really any adult in their environment who is a caregiver for them. Yep. And we have this nuclear family style of parenting post-industrial revolution that has actually seen us become much, much more isolated. Mm-hmm. We don't have these extended families. And, you know, there's some benefit to that as well. I mean, if your family's dysfunctional, there's an argument for actually not being attached to that family. But but in theory, the idea that, you know, I mean, I just have to say this before we wrap up, but look at the culture in which our mothers, especially in the United States, where you're lacking in support for parents in general. You have I think there's no official maternity leave for mothers. Right. I mean, if you imagine a woman who doesn't have the luxury of taking that time in the beginning to bond with her child, just to recover and to be nurtured herself, you know, after giving birth, after gestating and giving birth to this human being, mm-hmm. she's expected to return to the workforce right away. And she herself isn't taken care of in the way that I think that we need to take better care of mothers. And then on top of that, oftentimes, if the father is rather absent, then the burden, so to speak, I don't mean to make it sound like a burden, but the responsibility or the sole responsibility for the attachment, the emotional well-being, the nourishment of this child falls on her. And if for single parents, that's the case too. And I think single parents can do an amazing job of parenting, but it's a lot. It's a lot to expect one person to do. Exactly, based on what you said, these human beings, adults, also have needs. And I think the more healing we do, the more capacity in our system we have to actually meet the needs of our children. But even still, we don't often have the social support that we need, the infrastructure that could actually create a much better early life situation for children from the beginning.
Right. Yeah. I agree with that. And I think that now in the US, it's always ironic. I was talking with somebody the other day and they were like, oh, ACEs is so amazing. And I go, ACEs is amazing. It has actually shifted, becoming developing trauma-informed schools, the new, across the country, that'll have a huge influence. It'll start to go from the schools into the homes a little bit more there. But it's like, remember, not everybody realizes that ACEs was done 20 years ago. The ACEs study is from 1998. That's how long it takes for saturation in our culture to take place.
There was a longitudinal study as well, right? So they're looking at it over time. So
right.
It does
yeah.
Kind of hang up, but you're right.
Right. Yeah. And so, yeah. So once the results were, given out in 98, and then everybody else to go and back check the results and, look for, their own studies that, shoot off of that. It does take a long time for this movement. And so then we are still, in 2019, many people are being parented and parenting from the history and the intergenerational passing down of information that is still based on a guy who had a terrible relationship with his mother who said, you don't want to show much affection to your kids and, conflicted in there with a couple of other, theories in there, but we still have remnants of that in culture and in the advice that we're getting from parents. And that's where we're trying to say, listen, let's talk about the foundation. A lot of that was built on, it was built on a trauma-based foundation. The parents, the grandparents, everybody had their own degrees of trauma. They didn't know that they were having trauma. And then on top of that, you had advice being dispelled by experts who were traumatized that is fraught with, a lot of dangerous ideas, and they have infiltrated in through us, and we still need to kind of like, this is the moment in time for all of us as parents and adults even. I always talk about like One Broken Mom isn't just a parenting show because we all had parents, right? So there's a lot
non-parents
who go, I just need to know why I feel so bleh today. Well, let's talk about what life was growing up there. So,
that's right.
Corinne, it's, I know your kids are gonna be getting out of tennis here pretty soon.
Soon. Yeah. Yes. Another few minutes, but
yeah.
Can I just say, Amy, really quick, I love this platform. I am with you in really, elevating the conversation, contributing to the conversation around these things. Maybe there won't be one Dr. Spock that emerges again or a new doctor for this generation, but I am heartened, I think, by the many approaches now that are helping people heal their own lives first. I think for me, that is really, truly the most fundamentally important thing you could possibly do. And then, also having that added curiosity for the cultural component, the historical component, how that all shapes how you experience life. But really, it's going to be, for me, very much an embodied healing that needs to take place. And I believe, and this is what I experienced in that moment of total frustration and concern about how I was going to do this parenting thing, was I needed to be able to fundamentally trust myself first. And that meant establishing a better relationship with myself right away. That was the path I needed. And I knew that from there, I could trust what came from that place. Does that make sense?
Totally.
I could trust myself to respond in the way that I would need to respond from moment to moment, from situation to situation. I would trust myself to establish healthy and better boundaries, things like that. These are things that we can't just apply the information from books. We can't just apply what our parents said. My God, if anything, whatever my mom used to give me parenting advice, I think I was the most critical I could possibly be. I'd be like, how did that work out for you? Listen, I loved my mom. I really did. But when it came to parenting advice, I would immediately have resistance. Mm-hmm. And I think that ability really to be discerning and to be, to really have a critical eye, but in a healthy skepticism, mm-hmm. is really empowering. But we have to learn to trust ourselves first.
Yeah. And that's a great point, that really parenting today isn't about a book. There is no script for it. There are a few things that we can gather and learn, kind of where the pitfalls and hurdles might be. And there are some people I've met out here that are parenting experts that, you know, understand, that help us understand like what development needs to look like and stuff. But at the end of the day, kids are individuals. We are individuals. And you're absolutely correct. I think the biggest key to me, which is the same as to you, was my parenting skills, my passion in it, and the ability to be as whole as possible for my kids didn't come from a book. It came from therapy, and it came from healing, and it came from disengaging from the parts of the past that had, you know, gotten up into the brain here and gotten up into my head and twisted up a few things and unraveling all of that and being strong, because parenting is hard and my kids need their own needs and it's not the same what somebody else needs. Our conflict in terms of each of our needs and wants are different than any other family out there. But our abilities, you know, my ability to show up every day for them as a parent today, 1 year later, is only because of doing exactly what you said it was. It was examining where I needed to heal. And that's kind of the point of all of this, right? And that's the point of what I do.
It's kind of the point of all of
it. Yeah. Yeah. So.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
Well, it was great having you back on. I'm looking forward to season two. I'm wrapping up season one. So this will be my episode this upcoming weekend.
Cool.
And coming into season two, I'm looking forward to having you back in with me and stuff and to talk about some more engaging and awesome.
I would love to. I have some more ideas, but we'll talk about those, and I would love to come back. It'd be great.
Cool.
Thank you for listening to One Broken Mom. You can find podcast notes on my website at amiquiracone.com, and there I'll provide all links to all of the resources that we mentioned on the episode. Also, if you have any questions, comments, or ideas for other episodes, feel free to send me an email. And if you are interested in sponsoring the show, I'd love to have you be a part of the team. Finally, if you like what you hear, please share the podcast and leave a review so that others can find it. We are all here to get better together. I am the host, Ami Quiracone, and as always, I am super grateful to have you as a listener. Until next time, have a great day.